Welcome to the Answers for Elders radio show. Meet the trusted experts who will give you straight answers and will help guide you on the path of later life care. Now, here's your host, founder, caregiver, and CEO, Suzanne Newman.
And welcome back to everyone to Answers for Elders Radio Network. And I'm here with Andrea Lee from Legacy Estate Planning in Bellevue, Washington. And they serve all of the state of Washington and certainly can hook you up if you're out of the state of Washington with another estate planning attorney that you can trust. And certainly Andrea and I, we have been talking about those documents that you need to make sure that you're taken care of if anything ever happens that you become incapacitated. We hope that never happens, but obviously at times, you know, the luck of the draw, that may happen. So Andrea, last segment, we talked a lot about incapacity. Okay. We touched on the power of attorney basically, and for financial and for healthcare. How do those documents actually work together?
Susan, that's a super great question. And I think on a previous podcast, we also did a little discussion on the overall picture of estate planning. What
we
are
did.
The different tools that we might need? So I invite anyone to go back and listen to one of those. But I think one thing that a lot of my clients get a little bit confused about is how do those tools work together?
Mm-hmm.
And number one, thank you so much, Suzanne, for having me back. I'm just so excited to be here and to talk about aging and hopefully teaching a little bit to some individuals who can use some information.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So estate planning is very much like a puzzle. And within that puzzle, there are so many different pieces that they come together to create a picture, like a beautiful mm-hmm. picture of that puzzle. And the problem is frequently people might miss a piece or two of that puzzle. Like they think they've got the whole puzzle in place because they don't have a big, good understanding of what mm-hmm. a comprehensive estate plan looks like. But the reality is all those pieces come together and they serve a different purpose. Now, for example, some of my clients and most individuals need a slew of documents. You need a financial power of attorney.
Yes.
That says if you're incapacitated and not able to manage your own finances, who can manage your finances for you? They might also need a healthcare power of attorney that says mm-hmm. who can make those medical decisions, housing decisions on your behalf.
Right.
That HIPAA release that allows medical institutions to share information with agents, a living will that gives end of life direction, a disposition of remains that says, what do you want done with your body when you're gone? And then maybe a will or a trust that mm-hmm. disposes of your assets when you're gone. So those are some of the pieces of that puzzle. And the mm-hmm. reality is, depending on how a principal, that's the person who signs those documents, prepares them, determines how effectively and efficiently those documents could work.
Okay.
For example, some of my clients might say, hey, I want my oldest daughter to be the decision maker on everything. So that daughter is the healthcare power of attorney. She's the financial power of attorney. She's the executor of the estate. She's all of those tools. So that makes it maybe a little bit seamless. On the one hand, that can create a lot of burden for that oldest daughter mm-hmm. because she is doing all of it, which yep. I think, as you know, it's not unusual for us
and
to
find. And it can cause dissension within the sibling, especially when it comes to an executor.
Absolutely. Once that child rolls into that executor role, sometimes it is creating a lot of conflict.
Yeah.
Sometimes a parent might say, hey, you know what? My oldest child is an accountant and my second child is a nurse. So I'm going to name my oldest child as the financial decision maker, and they're the ones who will pay the bills. They might be the ones who file the taxes. They might be the mm-hmm. ones who, you know, make sure assets are being distributed to mm-hmm. the incapacitated adult if they're incapacitated. And then they might name someone else as their healthcare power of attorney. And mm-hmm. that healthcare power of attorney is the one who is going to make treatment decisions, mm-hmm. Make medication decisions, make housing decisions
mm-hmm.
while the principal is incapacitated. Now, on the one hand, in some instances, naming two agents in different roles can solve problems because you don't have one person doing everything. But in other instances, it can create conflict because, as you can imagine, maybe your healthcare power attorney is like, you know what? I really think mom would be better cared for in an adult family home. Because, you know, the care is going to be a little bit more personal. And I found this one right near my house. And then the financial power of attorney might say, I disagree and I'm in charge of the money. So who's going to pay for it?
Exactly. That's kind of was my situation with my mom.
Oh.
She assigned a power of attorney that didn't even live here. She was down here in Linwood with me. My former sister-in-law, she decided because she was much more malleable in personality. She wasn't as hard-nosed as me. And so she assigned her because she'd pretty much do anything my mother wanted her to do. And so what ended up happening is I had all the authority as the healthcare power of attorney, but no authority. And even the fact that, you know, when it came to getting her qualified for Medicaid, they didn't even tell me that she was out of money because I didn't know. And nobody told me because, again, there was this whole other curtain behind that I didn't have access to. And it was interesting because I always say now, it's like, wow, the nightmare that I went through for my mom. And then I was just crazy. And then we ended up having to get another attorney. I had to end up getting another attorney to help her get qualified for Medicaid, which was crazy. And it was crazy because we ended up having to send a revocation of her power of attorney to give it to me because it was just crazy. By that time, my mom was way, beyond her capacity. So that was so costly. It was expensive. It was overwhelming. So I know when you're saying, when you have two people, they got to be able to work together.
Right. And sometimes it works really well. And sometimes it's a nightmare, which in your case, it sounds like it was a nightmare.
Oh, it was horrible.
And that is definitely one of the downfalls of choosing different agents. Now, some of my clients choose to pick the same agent for everything, but they might want to impose additional like reporting requirements to keep other family members informed of what the agent is doing. So if they have a very large estate, they're putting a lot of trust in one person. They know they want the other kids to kind of have an idea of what's going on. So in some families, that's a good solution.
Sure.
In when we're drafting documents to make sure there's a little bit of a safety net, that information is being shared with the other kids or the other interested parties. Some families choose to name professional agents if they don't feel like they have any family members or close friends that can serve that role. So there are a lot of options with regards to powers of attorneys, but the two different types of powers of attorneys serve very different roles. And that's why they're different pieces of that puzzle. One of them says who manages the body and the health and the financial decisions. And the other says who manages the money and maybe sells the house and takes care of it. And it's so important to make sure that the agents communicate and can work clearly together if you name different people.
Absolutely. And it goes right down to communication, I think, too. You know, if someone is dedicated as power of attorney, their job isn't so much to be an advocate for themselves, but be an advocate for their loved one. And there's times when I had to really check my own value system saying, you know, well, I'd tell my mother not to take this medication because my mom she was different. She was wanting to be, you know, taking as many pills as possible to not feel pain. See, to me, I'm like, I'm not going to put pills in my body, but I had to realize over time that being power of attorney has to do with their value system, not mine. And I think that's appointing someone that can recognize that. I think when you talked about values, that's really important.
Oh, absolutely. And I think sometimes people are a little tempted to pick the agent as the person who is the easiest to get along with. Well, when people ask my opinion of who should I pick, if someone comes to me and says, I have four absolutely responsible children, I don't know how to pick between the two of them. I usually counsel them and I say, I don't know your children. You know your children. I would recommend you choose, number one, the child whose values you feel most reflect your own.
Correct.
And then number two, it doesn't have to be the most responsible child. They have to be responsible. But if you have four responsible kids, Doesn't have to be the one you think is the most, but
Right.
it should be the child who communicates the best.
I agree.
Because like you said, a lot of conflict in families, it's not because the child who might be making decisions or is managing affairs, it's not that they're doing anything wrong. They could be doing everything right. But if they're not communicating with their brothers and sisters, then that's where a lot of uncertainty and conflict arises.
Right.
So picking a great communicator is absolutely essential.
Yes. And obviously, through the whole part of, you know, to the point of when that power of attorney stops at the moment of death, that's a whole other conversation I think that we're going to have next, are we not?
Yes, we should, because we're talking about that puzzle, and I do get that call on the weekly. I don't want to say daily, but it's probably weekly about, hey, my mom died and my power of attorney doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's supposed to go. And if any of you are listening and if you have questions for me, then you are more than welcome to reach out to Legacy Estate Planning. You can drop us an email at info@waltar, and that's waltar.com.
And you know, I have to say to my listeners, each and every one of you, there is not a single client here in the state of Washington that I do not refer to Legacy Estate Planning. I think Andrea and Steve are the best in the business. They are fabulous with families. They are compassionate, caring, ethical beyond anything. Mm-hmm. And I am just so honored to have you guys on our platform. And so Andrea and I, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about what happens after death with those documents. And we'll be right back right after this. That was good. That was 12 minutes, almost exactly.
I looked at my clock this time. So I was like, okay.
Well, that was good. We had plenty of time, but it was perfect because we were at that. And I'm looking at the time too for you because we only have
let's
15
do
minutes.
One more.
Yep.
And then, that's what we'll do is we'll say, let's talk about the documents after.
Okay. And welcome back everyone to Answers for Elders Radio Network. And we're at part two of what do you do with these documents? And so Andrea Lee from Legacy Estate Planning in Bellevue, welcome back to the show. The first segment, we were so talking about power of attorney, how they work together and all those things. So obviously then after death, what happens?
Well, so in a nutshell, your power of attorney documents end the moment someone passes away. And if you are an agent named in a power of attorney document, and then you use that document after someone has died, that is a big no-no because you have completely lost all of your powers as an agent moment that person passed away.
Very true.
So at that point, once again, when we're talking about that estate planning puzzle, at that point, there's a document that everyone should have called the disposition of remains. That's a document that says, hey, when someone passes away, how do they want their remains treated? That way your family can know, yes, this person would like to be cremated, or maybe they want to be buried or composted, or they want the new green burial that's available in the state of Washington. So that's an important document to have in place because it offers a lot of guidance for your family members with regards to your physical being after somebody's passed.
And obviously, having your wishes be honored is so important. I remember when my father, all through his life, said, I want to be cremated. I don't want an expensive funeral, all these things. Of course, he had nothing in writing. So my stepmother, who didn't want him to be cremated, there was nothing in place. So guess what? He was buried. And of course, everybody in my, you know, siblings all said, well, Dad wanted to be cremated. It's like, he didn't write it down. And she had the say. So obviously, those are things I know that can happen often in families, can they not?
Absolutely. And if under the new laws of the state of Washington that passed, I think 2019-ish, it became much more difficult in some instances for families to handle the disposition of an individual remains. And that's why it's so important in today's society and today's laws in the state of Washington to have that written down. But not only is it important from a legal point of view, but as you said, with your personal experience, I think I've talked a little bit about my brother, Christian, who passed away, and how he had not, even though this is my job and I encouraged him to do planning, he was, 44 at the time, and he just didn't think he needed it. And he was hospitalized and he was very, very sick. And at the end of the day, he ended up spending 79 days in Swedish hospital, very ill. And at one point I was with him and the doctor said to him, that you're dying. And then he started crying and I started crying and he started all the, it still makes me emotional, all the, I'll nevers, like the things he'll never do in his life that he wished he could do. And that was so hard. But then he went on to the promise me's, you know, and one of the things he said to me was, when I die, I do not want sad music at my funeral, only happy music. And he said, and when you plan something, I want there to be food and I want it to be somewhere my dog can go, because he so dearly, he so dearly loved his dog. And when he died, that was such a blessing to me because it was something I could do for him. Something he had said to me he wanted done. And it made it so much easier to plan his celebration of life because he had given me some direction. And I view that as a gift that he gave me, because when I was planning a celebration of life, I was able to do what he wanted. And so I think that some of these estate planning documents, they're made not just so that the individual who becomes incapacitated or after someone dies, it's not really for them. It's really for their family members. It's for the people they've left behind so that they can honor their loved ones after they're passed and they can ensure that the decedent's wishes are followed.
And to think about that, I think a lot of people say, I don't want to fuss. And and really, it's about closure for those that are loved ones. And so I love the fact that you talk about those final wishes and realizing that it's important for you know, that the loved ones that are left behind, that they have an opportunity to come together and experience that level of closure. I know that a lot of people say, I don't want a service. Well, think again. Maybe the loved ones around you would like to have something. And I tried to talk to my husband about it. He goes, yeah, I suppose, because he doesn't want a fuss. He never wants a fuss. But obviously, those are things that are important, I think, to the loved ones that are left behind.
Right. And sometimes my clients are saying, I don't want a fuss. But then you might say, well, what about a nice dinner? Or what about something casual? If you have a plan, or if you don't want it, should we just leave it up to the discretion of your family? Because, you know, but it's just important. If you have an idea, write it down. Make it clear. Make it easy for your family when you're gone. So they don't need to sit around and debate. What did mom or dad or Aunt Susan want? Or Uncle Joe? You know, they're able to just follow through with that and make it easy on them.
I attached a map of where I want my ashes to go. I pointed, I did an X. They know exactly what the latitude and longitude is. I want to be right where we took my mother, the same place. So, you know, I want to do that. So those are things that, you know, when I have a friend, because I don't have children, that is my executor. And so it's important to me that she knows where to go, what to do. So absolutely. I love that you, you know, recommend those things.
Absolutely. Now, you know, that's the healthcare power of attorney that pretty much ends. The disposition of remains kind of takes over. But with regards to, you know, not just the physical person, we kind of need to look at, you know, the wishes with regard to their estate. Because like we talked about previously, as soon as an individual passes away, then their financial power of attorney stops. That agent who they have trusted to manage their affairs no longer has any legal authority to access their assets, to transfer ownership of their home, or to manage their financials, or personal property, or anything. And it's at that stage when someone passes away that typically their will takes over and the executor they've named in their will gets that power. Now, one thing we haven't spent a lot of time talking about, but I think is in one of our previous podcasts, or maybe Steve Waltar, the other attorney at my firm, might have talked a little bit about trusts. So
Yes.
some people create trusts while they're alive. And if a person has a trust, you can think of it as it's bridging the gap between being alive and being deceased. And that's because you create your trust while you're alive. And if you don't have a trust, your power of attorney ends the moment you die. But if you have a living trust, that trust continues and voyages over. And after you pass, your trustee just falls into that role. Right? So that is one of the compelling reasons to create a trust, is so that when someone passes away or when they face incapacity, that transition is much smoother. Whereas if an individual plans with a financial power of attorney and then a last will and testament, that power of that financial power of attorney ends upon death and the executor power starts. But that executor actually has zero power until they've gotten that will admitted into probate.
And it still probate takes time.
Oh, absolutely. So that trust transition is just a matter of, oops, let's create a document. We'll prove that this individual is the next trustee. Let's get started. With a will, you have to have the original will. We need to get it in front of a commissioner. We have to ask the commissioner to please appoint the executor. There is no guarantee they're actually going to appoint that executor. 90% of the time they do. We don't know. Can't say 100. Once that executor actually appoints that exec, once the, I'm sorry, the commissioner or judge appoints the executor, at that point, the executor actually has those powers and can start administering that will and start the probate process.
So if it with the trust, there you still need to have an executor, isn't that correct? And the executor is not part of the trust, it can be like an outside source. I guess that's my question.
So when people create a living trust or revocable trust, you still always have to have a will that names an executor. So in a nutshell, when you create a living trust, the goal is to avoid probate. And in order to make sure that happens, you have to make sure your trust owns your house. You need to make sure your trust owns most of your bank accounts, your investment accounts, and all of your assets are owned by your trust. And then if everything is done right, and if the sun and the moon align and everything goes just the way they go, then you don't need an executor to be appointed. However, sometimes things go a little haywire. Examples of that is maybe somebody created a trust, they put their house in the trust, they put their accounts in the trust, and then a couple of years later, they wanted to refinance. And then the bank, in the kindness of the bank's heart, takes the house out of the trust to
Oh my
facilitate that
gosh, yeah.
refinance. Then they don't bother to put it back in the trust. So that's a problem that we sometimes see. I mean, it's easy to remedy. It's an easy solution is we just put it back in the trust. But if someone, let's say, fails to follow up with putting it back in the trust, that's when we might have to rely on the executor of the will, because the sun and the moon did not align properly. Something went a little wrong. And so we still need that will for that just in case situation.
And you know, those things are so vitally important. And Andrea, I'm so glad we talked about this, and I'm so glad that you've been with us this afternoon. So tell us how we reach you.
Oh. Well, if anybody would like to schedule an appointment or ask some questions, you are more than welcome to email my law firm. You can email us at info, which is INFO, at waltar.com. And Waltar is a little tricky. It's spelled Waltar. Alternatively, you are more than welcome to call my law firm and schedule an appointment or ask us some questions. The number here is 425-455-6788.
Yes, and by the way, I happen to know this. You guys give a free consultation to anyone that's interested in reaching out.
Well, that's not quite true.
Oh.
So
I'm sorry. That's what I had on my paperwork. So I apologize.
I'm glad you asked. We give a free consultation to anyone who's a listener to the podcast. So if you're a listener to the podcast,
that's what we've got it.
Yes, you need to give us a call and you need to tell us that you heard us on this podcast. And we oftentimes will also send you a webinar to watch. It's just purely educational.
Perfect.
So it's like a little bonus that we give to podcast listeners.
Fabulous. So
if you're hearing us here, then you get a free consultation.
That's good. You have to mention Answers for Elders podcast.
Yes, you do.
I will remember that in the future. Andrea, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right. Thank you so much, Suzanne. And I look forward to our future podcast.
Perfect.
We at Answers for Elders thank you for listening. Did you know that you can discover hundreds of podcasts in our library on senior care? So visit our website and discover our decision guides that will help you also navigate decision making. Find us at answersforelders.com.